This is the Unconquered Podcast, unbiased, unrivaled, and unconquered coverage and analysis of Florida State football.
At Florida State, we won national championships and ACC championships.
We're back to some basics,
consistency in what we're doing.
Guys get more banged and bruised, working a bunch of different situations, making progress.
You have to have success so you know something, I can really do this.
This is the Unconquered Podcast. I'm your host, Jason Staples. Today on the show, we're going to look back at the Wake Forest game. We're going to look forward to the Syracuse game. And we're going to spend a little bit of time looking at the slightly more distant future and evaluating some of Florida State's potential future opponents in the ACC Championship game and also the BCS National Title game. All right, let's move on to segment one. Well, not much to say about the Wake Forest game, except that that was a total beatdown and a terrific defensive performance. Actually, one of the best defensive performances against the pass in the past 10 years. The total QBR that the defense forced in this particular game of .002 is among the best of the past 10 years. It actually is the best of the past 10 years, actually, now that I look at it. And that just goes to show exactly how far this Florida State defense has come. Even though that Wake Forest offense is a bit anemic at this point, in particular without their star receiver, Michael Campanero, the defense was truly dominant throughout. When you throw your first four passes from a quarterback who's actually he's a good player. Tanner Price is a good quarterback. When three of his first four passes get intercepted, that tells you exactly how suffocating the Florida State secondary was. And it was really something else to watch from the box, to see just how well this secondary is reading routes, is jumping on things so quickly and closing down passing windows so rapidly. There was just simply nowhere to throw. It's one of those things where this past summer I got a chance to look at some college film, also interspersed with some NFL film from coaching films, end zone views, all 22 views. And one of the things that's so remarkable that comes out, especially when you're looking at things from the end zone view, you can see exactly how much smaller the passing windows are in the NFL running the exact same play against the exact same coverage as they are in the college game. In the college game, those windows, Even against good college defenses, windows are usually much bigger than what you're going to see against the worst pro defenses, because those defensive players at the NFL level are so well schooled and they understand defense so well. They understand where guys are going to be so they don't take false steps. They don't make mistakes. They're where they should be. And so if you're going to make a play on offense, you have to be that much better. And if you're going to play at the quarterback position, you have such small windows to fit the ball into. And that's one reason why, you hear people talk about arm strength being more important at the NFL level than it is at the college level. I would say in particular, how quick your release is and how accurate you are is that much more, even more important than arm strength at the next level. But that's because the windows just shrink down. And it's not just because players are faster. In some cases, players in the college game, being younger and that sort of thing, are actually faster than what you get from NFL secondaries and from NFL linebackers. But they're processing things so quickly, and they're such film junkies, and they've got so much experience at the next level, that even if they're a half a step or a full step slower than they were when they first got into the league, they're two or three steps faster when it comes to diagnosing things. And that's the thing that stuck out to me in particular in this game. And we've been talking about it a little bit on this podcast and over on Noll Digest. It's one of the things we've been talking about a good bit, has been the development that we've seen so far from Florida State's back seven in how well they're able to do the pattern reading and the pattern matching that is taught in Jeremy Pruitt's system. It's the same sort of thing that Alabama teaches, and it's what basically every pro team has done for the last decade and a half at least, where instead of covering grass in a zone coverage, you might play zone. A lot of teams will play man at different points, but even when you're playing a zone coverage in a pattern read system, you have rules that you have to follow, that it's sort of like a matchup zone in basketball. If you think about the Syracuse matchup zone in basketball, you never under that kind of zone have a guy that's just guarding a part of the floor without a player there. You match up, you find the guy who's going to be coming through your area, and you know based on whatever offense that you're playing against that certain offensive principles of spacing are going to work a certain way. And so you know that when this guy comes through your zone, then you have to go ahead and let him move on, but you're going to move him on to the next guy, and you're going to communicate, and you're going to take the guy that's going to come into your zone, and you know that somebody's got to come into your zone because that's the way you have to space the floor. Syracuse is probably the best in the country at doing that, and has been, you know, for years in basketball. But what you've seen over the past 15, 20 years in football is application of the same principles basically to zone coverages in football. And, you know, everybody does it to some extent. One of the things that makes the NFL different, and that makes Alabama in particular really distinct from most college defenses, and Florida does it too with Muschamp, who coached under Saban. You get the same thing at LSU, where they do the same kind of thing. But there are very few teams that pattern match, pattern read on almost every coverage. Alabama, if they're playing a zone coverage, they're going to pattern match, period. And that's distinct. That's unusual. If they're going to be in a cover one, they're going to be pattern matching. It's going to turn into a kind of quasi man zone. The difference is that guys are going to be passing people off within zones, and you can't find the matchups quite as easily, find advantageous matchups quite as easily, because their defense is going to adjust. It's going to treat it as a zone. Their guys are going to let guys pass in and out of their zones, but they're going to pick them up as they come in as though it were man. And so that reduces the kinds of windows that you get. And at the NFL level, teams are so good doing this that that's part of why these windows close down. In the college game, there's very few teams that actually, first of all, have the horses, have the athletes to be able to do it, and have the players to be able to execute that all that well. The other thing is that it's something that's difficult to teach. It's something that it takes a lot of attention. It takes a lot of attention to detail. It takes a lot of persistence and a whole lot of reps and practice and careful film study. And it takes smart players who are going to study and who are going to work at the mental side of the game in order to run it successfully. This is something that I talked briefly, brought it up actually toward the end of the press conference against Wake Forest, about how you can see this development with, in particular, Nate Andrews, and has shown this the last couple weeks, where you can see how these guys are actually making the adjustment in terms of pattern reading. And Fisher, you know, of course, he nodded big time. He goes, "Oh yeah, you know, they're getting that down." And he's like, "Now that pattern matching stuff," he's like, "it's hard to teach, but boy, you start getting it right, and it'll make your day miserable." And that's basically what it does for an offense. And the reason that it does that is, on offense, what you always want to try to do is find these advantageous matchups, and you try to design your various route combinations and so on to take advantage of weaknesses in zone defenses. So, you know that if there's a if there's a cover two, that there are certain weaknesses that a cover two has, where, you know, down the middle in that middle seam, down the sidelines at about 18 to 20 yards between the cornerback zone, which is usually going to be in that flat area, and where the safety is going to have some trouble getting to the sideline. There's a little bit of a hole there. Those are places that you're going to want to pick on. But the thing is, if somebody's playing a cover two with pattern matching principles, you might try to get a guy into that zone. But because the players on the underneath coverage reads the releases, there may not be that space anymore where you're expecting it to be in a cover two. That cover two kind of morphs to a quasi cover two man under that, you know, depending on how your guys release. And suddenly that's gone, and you've got a guy that gets his hand on the ball. These sorts of things are the things that those pattern matching principles make much more difficult. And you could see this actually. In the Miami game, you know, we mentioned this before. In the Miami game, Nate Andrews got beaten on a seam route where he was supposed to have, based on the pattern matching principles, it was a seam route from the inside receiver, and he was the inside. He was playing the money position, which is a replacement for one of the linebackers. It's sort of a dime position. He's going to be responsible for the curl flat area. And also for the seam. Basically, what he's got to do is he's going to read the release of that number two receiver. Essentially, you're counting in from the outside. So the furthest outside receiver is the number one receiver on your side, and the number two receiver is going to be in the slot. He's going to read that guy's release, and if the guy releases vertically, then it's Andrew's job to sink back and take away the seam in the coverage that you had. And early in the game, you could see that in the second quarter, Morris was able to complete that pass. In the second half, they went back and did the exact same thing, and that time Andrews read the release and did exactly what he was supposed to do, got his head around and got the interception on exactly the same throw. And Morris, I think, assumed that it would be there because it was there earlier, but you could see Andrews grow over the course of that game, and the same thing happened a couple times against Wake Forest, where you're seeing guys make that read, where they're recognizing what their responsibility is in the coverage. They're applying their rules very quickly. They're not thinking as much as they were before. And so now all of a sudden you're getting guys that are actually getting to the spot that the quarterback is supposed to be throwing to before the receiver does. They're actually making the break before the receiver does, because they know, based on the rules that they've covered all week in practice, that if this guy releases vertically, then he must be going here. And so you just go where he's going. And so when he gets there, you're already there, and you may already have your hands on the ball. And that's something that the Florida State defense is now doing with greater regularity. That is, and with the secondary, with the quality of athletes that they have in that secondary, where there's probably seven guys on this team right now that are healthy. You add Tyler Hunter, and that's an eighth. There are probably seven guys in the secondary right now who will be first three round picks in the NFL draft, which is remarkable. You put that kind of talent out there, and you have them coached and disciplined to do those things, and those passing windows are microscopic. There's simply not a place to throw, and if you do throw it out there, those guys are catching the football. You know, even Darby's caught a pass here and there. So it's remarkable what's going on the defensive side of the ball, and seeing the development at this point. This is one of the best secondaries I've seen play in person in years. It may be the best. And as this team moves forward, I don't see any team on the schedule with receivers and with a group that's going to make this team really that's going to cause this team any difficulty really downfield in terms of the secondary. And it allows the defense a lot of flexibility to focus on stopping the run, because they know that these guys are going to be covering that tight, and they're not going to, because of the quality safety play and because of the way that they're making these reads well, they're not getting beat deep either. And so, I mean, at this point, this defense is really rolling. It's exactly as we expected it might be by the end of this year. We knew that there would be growing pains early in the year, but this defense has really turned the corner, and it's, I think, the best defense that Florida State's had in quite a while. Now, how good they'd be if, you know, Brandon Jenkins or Bjorn Werner had actually stayed is mind-boggling, but you know, this is a really, really, really good defense, and there's no reason at this point to think that any team left on the schedule is going to give them a whole lot of trouble defensively. Now, offensively, they really didn't play as well as they could have. I think some of it had to do with over the course of part of the first quarter, the end of the first quarter, and a good portion of the second quarter, the offense went about 40 minutes of real time, maybe 45 minutes of real time, without actually touching the football. And there was a stretch where the offense only got the ball for four plays, and Florida State scored 28 points, because you had the two pick sixes, you had two other turnovers that set things up for for the offense there to score very quickly. And so the offense really never had an opportunity early on to get in rhythm. And I think that the offense that showed the offense never really did get in rhythm in this game. And I think Fisher after the game was not especially pleased with that. I think after looking at the tape a little bit, he wasn't perhaps quite as upset about it, because again, I think you recognize that it's just hard to get into rhythm when you don't have the ball. That said, there are some times where Winston in this particular game played just a little bit like a freshman, where he locked on some guys. I think once Benjamin went out, he locked on to O'Leary a little bit more. There were some places where, I think he's still adjusting to when teams play him with max coverage, and he has to really be disciplined and taking what's given rather than looking downfield all the time. And that's his tendency. If there's two guys and there's a 15 yard route and a 5 yard route, he's going to throw the 15 yard route more often than not. And it's just something that as teams max cover and as teams try to take those routes away, then I think that's basically the way that it works. So anyway, we're going to go ahead and move to the second segment, where we're going to have a guest. We're going to have Mike McAllister from QsNation.com join us. So give us just a moment, and we'll be back with the second segment. Okay, joining us on the program now is Mike McAllister, the publisher of QsNation.com. Mike, good to have you with us.
Thanks, Jason. Glad to be here.
So we've got a game coming up that, according to the folks in the desert, isn't expected to be all that competitive. But Syracuse has been a pretty physical football team this year, and we did see if anything, one place where Florida State has been a little bit vulnerable, or at least they were early in the year, as you saw against Boston College, is they did give up some. They have given up some yardage between the tackles here and there. So that's got to be something that we're looking at. Why don't you give us a little bit of insight on how the Syracuse side is looking at this game and sort of fill Florida State fans in particular on what we really ought to know about Syracuse going in.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what you said, running between the tackles is the only way Syracuse, I think, is going to have a chance to move the ball on Florida State. That's where they have made their hay this whole season, is on the ground attack, and they use a variety of different formations to kind of run only really a few plays, but they give defenses a lot of looks to try to confuse them. They run between the tackles. You'll see Jerome Smith and Prince Tyson Gully will be the two primary ball carriers, with redshirt freshman George Morris, who is a guy that has Syracuse fans really excited about the future of running back. He'll get sprinkled in there a little bit. But those are the two primary guys and the best weapons that Syracuse has found offensively, at least, week to week, being consistent. The passing game has really, really struggled, and it's not for the lack of pass protection up front. The offensive line has been pretty solid and gotten better as the year has gone on, and that has helped increase the rushing attack as the season's gone on as well. But Terrell Hunt is a first-year starter. He's a redshirt sophomore. He started the season as the backup to Drew Allen, who transferred in from Oklahoma, who was very poor in his first two or three games and has since given up the job to Hunt. The main difference between the two is both have struggled to pass the ball and have a consistent passing attack for Syracuse, is that Hunt can hurt you with his legs. Syracuse likes to run some quarterback draws in different times, and if he looks downfield, goes through his reads, and no one's open, he has the ability to scramble and make a play out of nothing. He's a big kid. He has an okay arm. Nothing that's going to jump out at you, obviously nothing close to a Jameis Winston. He struggles with staring down his primary read at times and is not very accurate on the deep ball. But the other part of the passing attack that has really struggled for Syracuse is the receivers. They lack a big-time playmaker. True freshman Brizzly Esteem has stepped up the last couple of games as a guy that primarily plays out of the slot and catches short little passes out in the flat and tries to make a couple people miss in space. Ashton Broyles fulfilled that role earlier in the season, but they've moved him to the outside to try to take advantage of his ability down the field. But he hasn't been able to gain great separation. Jared West is a junior wide receiver who they thought was going to be the number one guy coming in, but he's been pretty underwhelming this year. Did make a very nice one-handed catch last week at Maryland, but again, has struggled to get open and struggled to gain separation, especially against really good corners. The Clemson secondary, when they came and played Syracuse in the Dome, were very physical, as I imagine Florida State will be with the Syracuse receivers this week, and just really frustrated the Orange receivers. They couldn't get off the line of scrimmage and couldn't get open pretty much the entire game. Defensively, Syracuse makes its mark by being very physical, especially up front. Their defensive line is not necessarily outstanding, especially on the edge as far as having a big-time pass rusher, but they're solid players who can make plays at times. Jay Bromley is a defensive tackle who's a senior who is playing at an all-ACC level. He has 8 sacks, which leads the team. He's just been a disruptive force against the run and against the pass all season long, really getting some good pressure up the middle as well as making some plays in the backfield. The linebackers have been a real strength the last 2 weeks. They've only given up 3 total points in the last 2 games. They're blitzing up from all over the formation. Cameron Lynch, Marquis Spruill, and Dyshawn Davis are the 3 guys to keep an eye on there. And they're going to move all over the formation. They're going to blitz from the outside, blitz up the middle. Chuck Bulla, the defensive coordinator, likes to bring pressure all over the place, frequently, probably 75-80% of the snaps. He's going to bring an extra rusher. So look for that as they try to maybe get to Jameis Winston before the receivers have a chance to get open, because the secondary has been very hit and miss and very inconsistent all year. They've had some communication breakdowns and have really struggled to stay with some receivers, especially some of the better receivers, like with Sammy Watkins came to the Dome and torched them. I can imagine that's going to be a huge challenge for them this week against Florida State. So if Florida State, obviously more talented all over the place, but they're probably going to attack the Syracuse secondary early and often to try to get out to those big leads that they seem to be able to get out to almost every week.
Yeah, one of the things that's interesting is, you know, looking at the way that they that Syracuse seems to like to blitz as much as they do, you know, that's really burned, that's backfired on a lot of teams that have tried to do that against Winston so far this year. You know, he's been maybe he's been actually better against the blitz than he has been when teams try to cover him. And I've been sort of wondering, it's going to be interesting to see whether Syracuse kind of sticks with their bread and butter, whether they actually decide to, you know, continue to bring those fire zones, those 5-man rushes, and try to put pressure on, or whether they actually decide that maybe it would be better to do what, say, Wake Forest did and what Miami did, and try to cover him, you know, go max cover a little bit more, and just keep guys in front and tackle and link, you know, shorten the game. Don't give up big plays, these sorts of things, and then hopefully be able to run the ball well enough to stay in it. That would be my approach. But then the problem is if you that's not what you do. If you have to really go against what you've been doing all year, that gets a little bit more difficult. So do you actually think that they will continue to blitz the same way, even though Winston has had as much success as he's had against the blitz so far this year?
Yeah, I think they'll do a couple of things. I still think they're going to try to bring pressure. The one time Syracuse defensively got away from what they normally do was against Georgia Tech, and they went from a 4-3 base to a 3-4 base and tried to use that to attack the triple option, and it backfired big time because it's not what they practice on a regular basis, and so guys blew assignments and weren't sure where they were supposed to be and where their reads were, who was supposed to stay on the edge, who was supposed to collapse the middle. So Syracuse is going to bring pressure. It's just, I think they're going to try to tailor it a little bit because of the success that you mentioned that Winston has had against pressure this year. They're going to do different things where maybe they bring 3 linebackers up to the line of scrimmage and they blitz one and drop the other 2 into coverage to try to take away some of the hot reads, maybe get into a passing lane. I think Syracuse is going to try to do as much as they can to confuse Jameis Winston, because if they try to play straight up and sort of just stay back into coverage, they don't have the athletes to stay with all the playmakers that Florida State has all over the field. That's just, you know, the long and short of it, the hard fact. And Syracuse fans, I think, even the most diehard passionate fans really understand the talent disparity that's going to be on the field. But you can make up for that with some confusion. And if they can get to Jameis Winston with Dyshon Davis, who's been absolutely unbelievable the last 2 weeks with his blitzes and how he comes off the edge and even comes on some stunts and a couple of delayed blitzes as well. If they can get to Jameis Winston a couple times early, maybe confuse him a little bit with some zone blitzes and with some guys dropping back into coverage and mixing up when they bring pressure and when they don't, that's really the only chance I think Syracuse has to stop the Florida State offense is to try to force them into some mistakes with some confusing looks.
Yeah, one thing that does definitely stick out, that has stuck out to me about the Syracuse defense, looking at their prior games, looking at how they played earlier in the season, really there's only two teams that have had any success running the ball against them, excluding Tulane, who that wasn't really a game, and they got a lot of garbage yards sort of at the end of that game. But Northwestern had some success early on. They averaged a little over four and a half yards a carry. And then Georgia Tech obviously had quite a bit of success in the running game. But everybody else, it's interesting. I mean, you start going down the list, Penn State was held to a yard and a half per carry on 38 carries. I mean, that's awfully good. Especially in a loss. I mean, you don't expect to lose when you're able to do that. Clemson ran it 45 times for 3.5 yards a carry. Wake Forest was held to 2.2. Maryland was held to 2.2. I mean, those are very good rushing numbers for a defense. I mean, when you're giving up 3.5 yards a carry on defense, you're usually doing a lot of things right. You got to think that's going to be something that they're going to really want to keep up against Florida State to try to let Florida State be one dimensional. The problem then, though, is that Florida State wants to come in and throw, and they're going to want to take advantage of things as much as they can. And you look at Clemson may only have gone for 3.5 yards a carry in the running game, but they averaged 14.6 per attempt in the passing game. I wonder whether that is sort of the byproduct of the aggressive fronts that they're playing and producing that pressure. If you've got flaws in the secondary, that may expose it. But at least you're not just getting beat up front, that sort of thing. And I guess when bodies arrive or something like that in future years, you can at least sell them now on we're gonna put pressure on, that sort of thing. I just wonder about whether. I guess for me, I'm just thinking in terms of, as a coach, I just wonder about whether I'd really want to give up 15 yards of play rather than keeping those guys back. But anyway, offensively, looking at again what they do best. I mean, you've got 220-pound starting running back. You're looking at or almost 230 actually. You're looking at, I'm assuming that again, they're going to try to shorten this game. Are we going to see any option stuff given the mobility of the quarterback? What can we expect on that front? Because, again, I don't expect that Syracuse is going to want to throw a whole lot in this. Are we going to see option stuff? Are we going to see some zone read type stuff? Or are they just going to try to line up and run inside zone or power or whatever? What exactly should we expect here?
You're going to see a little bit of a mix. They showed a couple of option looks throughout the season, but really not very much. I doubt if you see an option look, you might see it on one play, maybe two. It's not going to be anything you're going to see consistently. Obviously not anything close to what Georgia Tech does. As far as the different rushing attacks, they do a variety of things. You'll see Terrell Hunt line up in the shotgun, in the pistol. He'll line up under center, and they do several different things. They do some of the zone read, the read option, the type of rushes where usually they'll do that with Jerome Smith, and then they'll sprinkle in Prince, Tyson, Gully. But a lot of what they do is they'll line up sometimes with two tight ends, they'll line up sometimes in the I formation, and they'll do a lot of power runs in between a tackle. They'll do a couple of stretch plays. Usually it's Prince, Tyson, Gully, the backup running back, when they try to go to the outside because he's got a little bit more speed and quickness than Jerome Smith does. And when they try to go power, it's Jerome Smith. He's really improved his short yardage running this year from last year, even though he's still about the same size last year. He just didn't run with the same type of power on short yardage situations. So you're going to see that, and I think you're right that Syracuse is going to try to shorten the game. It's interesting because offensive coordinator George McDonald has sort of been in between a rock and a hard place all season. He wants to run a wide open four or five wide receiver, you know, throw the ball all over the place type of an offense, but he has the personnel to run a power offense. And so he's kind of tried to mix in both elements in order to, one, take advantage of the talent he has, but B, show recruits that, hey, this is the type of offense that we're going to be running. It's going to be exciting. You're going to want to come in and play on this in the fast track in the Carrier Dome. So it's been kind of him sort of figuring out the right balance between those two things in order to be successful. And I think over the last couple of weeks, the play calling has improved dramatically, especially because they've been giving Jerome Smith the ball more. And Syracuse's best chance at moving the ball in Florida State, I think, is going to Smith, is going to Tyson Gulley. And then George Morris, again, the third running back that can come in and is pretty good himself, especially with the way the offensive line is blocked, especially on the left side behind Sean Hickey and Rob Trudeau. Those are the two guys that they're going to want to run behind primarily. And if they have any chance at staying in this game, that's how they're going to have to do it, behind that power rushing attack. Again, you're going to see a variety of formations and a variety of looks where they kind of run two or three plays out of those looks to try to shorten the game, keep the Florida State offense off the field. And again, they have to take care of the ball and not turn it over, because we saw what happens when you do last week when Florida State took apart Wake Forest.
Yeah, that actually bringing up the lines. I know that Syracuse has been pretty physical on both sides, but what do they have in terms, especially up front on the offensive line? What are they bringing into this game in terms of experience and that sort of thing? Because I mean, obviously, you know, having a big back helps. Having some skill guys help, but you know, games are won up front. What exactly do they have going in terms of the offensive line? And then after that, we'll move on to a couple other things that may be of interest as well. So, but in particular, what about the offensive line and how is that looking coming into this for Syracuse?
Well, Sean Hickey is the best offensive lineman they have, and he is an NFL draft pick. You know, he's the starting left tackle. He was last year, you know, many people will recognize the name Justin Pugh as a starting right tackle for the New York Giants right now. He was a left tackle at Syracuse last year, but he started the season injured, and when he was hurt, Sean Hickey was over at left tackle filling in for him and did a very nice job. And then Pugh came back, moved to left tackle, and Hickey moved back to right tackle. This year, with Pugh gone, he's been at left tackle all season. He's been really, really strong for Syracuse and has really picked up his play the last couple of games, especially the unit as a whole has been pretty good in pass protection. You haven't seen a ton of pressure on Terrell Hunt, and he's been able to sit in the pocket and sort of survey the defense. Part of the problem is no one can get open. But Rob Trudeau is a second-year starter. He took over as a redshirt freshman in the middle of last year and really helped turn the running game from a weakness into a strength, which was part of Syracuse's stretch run last year where they won 5 out of 6 games. Mackie McPherson is a senior. He's a four-year starter. He was very undersized when he showed up at Syracuse at only 250 pounds, but he's bulked up to 290. He's a very, very smart player. He's the one that's going to make all the protection calls and all the adjustments up front. Really knows his stuff, knows the offense, and is capable blocker as well. Nick Robinson at right guard is a sophomore, but he's a first-year starter. He's been part of the rotation a little bit the last couple of years, but hasn't gotten a significant amount of snaps. This year, he's been the starting right guard all season. He's solid, but he's not spectacular. Ivan Foy is the right tackle. He started out as the starting right guard last season, but was replaced by Rob Trudeau, who I mentioned midway through the season, and they moved Foy to tackle in the offseason as they had a vacancy there. And he's been much better than people thought he was going to be coming into the season. But again, not, you know, a stud all ACC type of a player. He's, you know, sort of a solid lineman and not really much more than that at this point. But that's the weakness in the offensive line, is the right side. There's not a ton of experience over there, and that's where the least talented of the starting five are, and that's sort of where opponents have attacked when they've tried to bring pressure on Syracuse.
So finally, in terms of this game, sort of what do you expect from the Syracuse side, really? I mean, what really is expected, sort of looking at it from the Syracuse angle here? What might be expected by those on the inside?
Well, I think most people that have a reasonable football mind to go into this game understanding the huge talent gap that is between Syracuse and Florida State, but they also understand Syracuse is going to come into this game, play pretty loose. They're going to have nothing to lose. They understand what they're going up against, and, you know, perhaps the best team in the country, the team that I think is the best team in the country. You know, I'm part of the college football poll for Scout, and I've had Florida State as my number one team the last 3 weeks. They're just loaded all over the place. But Syracuse is going to come in. They're going to play hard. That's the way they play all season, is regardless of the situation, they're going to go after you, they're going to challenge you, and they're going to go hard the entire game. And regardless of what the score is, Syracuse is going to keep fighting and playing hard the whole game. You're going to see that. But I think realistic expectations are try to keep it respectable, and I think that's sort of the mantra among the media, is if Syracuse can keep it maybe to 21, 28 points, you come out of that going, all right, that's not too bad. You just don't want to lose, you know, 65-3 or something. That's a little embarrassing. But that might be what ends up happening, because the talent gap is definitely real. And Jameis Winston is just unbelievable. And Syracuse doesn't have a consistent quarterback that can make up for some of the deficiencies they have in other areas.
All right. Well, let's write it right here at the end. Let's move on to just talking a little bit. Obviously, you guys are new to the ACC, just sort of wondering now, you know, almost through the season, sort of how, sort of getting you to reflect a little bit on how that first year, that inaugural campaign, is going in the ACC, and whether also that's changed anything in terms of recruiting. And in terms of the overall outlook for the Syracuse program, and whether, you know, sort of the energy level around the program and all of that, I know that that for some people they didn't expect Syracuse to quite have as much success as they've had so far this year. So obviously that's got to be something that's exciting within the fan base. But just in general, can you reflect a little bit on sort of your first year within the ACC? And just the way that that's playing out, both on the field and in recruiting.
Yeah, I mean, recruiting wise, I'll start there. It's definitely helped, and you've heard a lot of recruits mention that, and some kids that might not have considered Syracuse otherwise. But it's obviously a much more prestigious thing to be part of the ACC, especially when you can go down to some of the Florida kids that aren't being recruited by a Florida State or Miami and say, hey, you can come here and have a chance to play against those guys that aren't recruiting you, and maybe show them that they should have. And, you know, there's a lot of kids in Florida that are talented, and obviously Florida State and Miami can't get all of them, although they do get, you know, those two in Florida do get a large chunk of them. So it's definitely helped on the recruiting front. As far as the buzz around the program, I think it's nothing but positivity right now, especially after they've won the last two. They're one game away from bowl eligibility, and most fans and media around Syracuse thought if they got to a bowl this year, being the transition year where you had huge question marks at quarterback and wide receiver and even along the defensive front line as well, with all the question marks, a brand new coaching staff, being able to get to a bowl and build off of the bowl team that you had the year before in a conference where the talent level is that much higher would be a major win for Syracuse, and they're in a pretty good position right now to do that. I think fans are starting to buy in. I know for me personally, it's exciting going into the Dome and having Clemson come in. It's exciting to see to go travel and see stadiums like, you know, Maryland and Georgia Tech and North Carolina State and even Florida State. And I think it's pretty cool. It's nice to have what I call legitimate football instead of having, you know, a Temple team come in that's, you know, 2-8 or whatever the situation is. It definitely helps the atmosphere in the Carrier Dome. The attendance is still down a little bit from where they want it to be, but I think it's getting there as the buzz starts to build. But definitely a lot of positivity around the program. Recruiting has picked up a little bit. And I think Syracuse fans and the athletics department is very happy to be part of the ACC. Understands it's definitely a jump up in talent level, but in order to play with the best, you have to, you know, you have to be willing to face them week in and week out. And obviously, in this conference, you do. And it's just been a pretty cool thing for Syracuse, and I think it only is going to help the program in the long run.
All right, Mike, thanks again for being on the program. Again, that was Mike McAllister from QsNation.com, your home for Syracuse coverage on the web. And I think the Syracuse people are really actually taking the right view here, that they understand sort of where they're at as they're new in the ACC and as they're moving up to the level of play in this conference. Although, you know, really they're already a 500 team in this conference, as you might expect. The ACC has not been especially good over the past few years, so it's not surprising to see a team like Syracuse have some success in the ACC. That said, there were no teams in the Big East least anything like Florida State or even Clemson. So, you know, there is a bit of an adjustment there, but the realism of that fan base is actually pretty refreshing, looking at them saying, you know what, the best thing we can do against Florida State right now is try to keep it as close as we can, you know, lose fighting hard and showing that we're going to compete for the near future. And I think that that's basically all that you can expect at this point. I don't think that this Florida State team is going to be a team that's going to lose one of these games. It's always difficult to win all your games, but I don't see especially the playmakers on the outside for Syracuse to really threaten Florida State. It would take a lot of turnovers, and I just don't see that happening. At the end of the day, I think that McAllister's idea of what's going on here, and actually they had as he mentioned, John Garcia also had an article up on QsNation.com where he's talking about scouting Florida State, where he had a very good outlook in terms of how Florida State matches up with Syracuse and all that. I think that they've been very, very realistic in terms of what to expect. I do think that this game probably winds up a 35 or 40 point game, sort of at the bottom end. It's Florida State's last home game, and they're probably going to come out, and again, they're going to pound a team that just does not have the talent level at this point to be able to compete. It's not going to look like the Wake Forest game, though, because Syracuse will not be overwhelmed the same way that Florida State was able to overwhelm Wake Forest. Syracuse is more respectable right now up front. Wake Forest has a few good players on each line. Actually, one of Wake's better players, still coming back from injury on the offensive line. And then, of course, Nikita Whitlock is a nightmare to block up front. But aside from those guys, they don't have, a lot of horses up front. And Syracuse, as you heard, has some experience up there and has some bodies. And they're going to be a physical team. They are going to be able to run the football a little bit. They're going to be able to shorten this game just a little bit more. So at the end of the day, I think that this is a realistic outlook. I think we're probably looking at, I won't set my score just yet, but I think that we are probably looking at a game that's around where the spread is now. All right, let's go ahead and move on to the third segment, where we're going to talk about the potential opponents that Florida State has in the postseason. Well, what a difference a week makes. Last week on the program, we were discussing whether or not Oregon or Alabama would actually lose a game, and we put odds about 70%, 75% or so on the last podcast that Oregon or Alabama would lose this last weekend, even though both of them were favored, even though you should favor both of those teams in those two games. It was still about 70% likely that one of the two would lose, and as it turns out, Oregon was the unlucky loser in that Thursday night game against Stanford. That said, I have to say, the more I think about that matchup, the more I think that if those two teams had played 10 times, I don't see Oregon making as many mistakes as they made to really give Stanford the game early on. Obviously Stanford was able to dominate them up front, but they were also the beneficiary of Oregon turning the ball over several times in key situations. And, they were able, with the dominance up front, was able to shorten the game to 9 possessions for Oregon, which is, critical in dealing with Oregon, if you're Stanford. But and what that does is that makes those turnovers, if you're Oregon and you're used to getting 14 or 15 possessions, you only get 8 or 9. Each turnover that they have effectively gets multiplied in its impact by 2. Well, they were able to force a couple of those key turnovers inside the red zone. They were able to get a few key stops early, and those things change a little bit early on. And I think it's very possible that Oregon, who obviously got some breaks late but did score 20 points in the fourth quarter, it's very possible that Oregon would win that game and potentially would win by a decent amount if the game had just gone a little bit differently early on. It's just remarkable how the game of football can work, where two teams can play, and if those two teams played 10 times, they might split it. Oregon even might win six. I think at the end of the day, Oregon actually might be the better team of those, even though they're not quite as good up front. I think overall, if those two teams keep playing, the difference might actually be in Oregon's favor over the long haul if they played a series. But fortunately for Florida State, they don't. Stanford was able to come out and dominate early on and dominate up front and change that game. The Alabama LSU game, I think, was pretty much as expected, that LSU was able to challenge them, was able to hit them in the mouth early, and they're expose again some of Alabama's weaknesses that had been exposed earlier in the year. But LSU at the end of the day just is not a good enough football team to carry on and actually win that game. In particular, once they had actually fired, they'd already taken their best shot in the first quarter when they should have been up, 10 or 14 points, 14 or 10 to nothing, and came out of the first quarter down 3-0. Once I saw that they'd actually taken their best swing at that point and couldn't make it count, it was pretty clear that Alabama was going to come away a winner in that game, because they simply were not going to be outplayed all game. And, LSU wasn't able to take advantage of it. Now, looking forward, that said, I'm not convinced right now that Alabama is going to win out. Alabama has a couple tough games left. And the one that I would actually circle is if Missouri is able to make the SEC championship game by winning the East, Missouri is going to be a bad matchup for Alabama. Alabama continues to struggle at the corner positions. They continue to struggle in the secondary by and large. They don't have safeties that do a whole lot, that do especially well in single coverage. They don't cover the slot all that well. And, they would be going against a spread team that I think can be every bit as good against Alabama as Texas A&M was, in particular once Franklin's back at quarterback, which he should be next week. That Missouri team is going to be very dangerous to Alabama, especially offensively. But they also have a very physical and they've got a fast defense. They're very physical up front. Bama will get their points. Bama will be physical, and will get their points against a team like Missouri. But the question is whether Bama can get enough stops. I'm just not persuaded that Bama defense is of the level that prior defenses have been. When you look at the way that Odell Beckham Jr. Was able to get open against them, the way that the LSU receivers were able to get open downfield. If you put them out there with Doriel Green, Beckham, and some of these other guys from Missouri, and I think Missouri is probably the only team in the country that could potentially put its receivers up against Florida State's and not necessarily want to trade units. That Missouri unit is very, very good, and they've got some size, which the Alabama corners have struggled with so far this year. It could be a very, very interesting SEC championship game. And Missouri is a good team. I mean, they're 11th or 12th in the F+ right now. They're a good football team. So I'm looking forward to the SEC championship game and seeing how that goes, with the Alabama Missouri game. And honestly, I wouldn't be very surprised if at the end of the day, the national championship game wound up being Florida State Missouri, because I don't think Ohio State's going to win out. I think Ohio State's going to have a whole lot of trouble with Michigan State. They may well win that game, but I think that again is going to be a very difficult game for them. I'm not sure that's a good matchup for them. I don't think Baylor is necessarily going to win out either. So if that happens, and then all of a sudden you get an upset of Bama if Missouri is able to upset Bama in the SEC championship game, it's hard not to see Missouri actually jumping to the front of the line there, jumping Stanford, and actually moving to the front of the line, given the way that Missouri would have had quite a few marquee wins, including over the defending national champions, the two-time defending national champs. And it's unlikely that the voters would actually take a Pac-12 team like Stanford and put them in over the SEC, over a one-loss SEC champ. I'm not sure I see that happening. So that's one thing that could be interesting. Of course, you've got to favor Bama, in terms of, they continue to be, they are the two-time defending national champs. They continue to be terrifically consistent. They continue to be a very good team. they're the most likely opponent if Florida State is able to make the national championship game. But I don't think anybody should overlook Missouri here. And, you know, then, of course, Ohio State could be a sacrificial lamb if somebody stumbles. You know, I don't think that they would have any shot in a national championship game. We'd be looking at a game that would be about as competitive as the Miami game or the Clemson game. They simply do not have the talent right now on defense, and they're, you know, they're a long way away from the Alabama or FSU level on defense right now, and offensively they have not really played anybody that can take that can force any problems for them. I mean, we'll see how they play against a Michigan State defense that is very good. It's still not quite at the elite level that Florida State's defense is playing at, in particular in terms of personnel. But, you know, again, I'm not sure that they're going to be there. It's tough to win all your games. You have to give them credit that they've done that so far through almost 2 years. But I'm not sure they're going to be able to win out. Baylor, I think with the loss of their top receiver, I think is going to be a factor. But I think the bigger factor is as they continue to play, their schedule continues to get more difficult, and, you know, just a little bit of attrition comes in toward the end of the year. I think that we will see Baylor probably drop a game. Now, in terms of, you know, looking forward to the other possibility, Florida State's going to be in the ACC championship game. I don't think there's a whole lot of question that it's going to be Virginia Tech that Florida State's going to play against. You know, it could be Duke, it could be Miami still, you know, technically, mathematically, it could be, you know, either of those teams. It also could technically be Georgia Tech, but I don't see that actually happening. I don't see Duke beating both Miami and North Carolina, who started to play a little bit better. I don't see that happening. And at the end of the day, I think Virginia Tech winds up there, and Virginia Tech is a better team than people actually realize. Even though Duke actually beat them, if you look at that game, that it was very much the sort of game that Miami had against Florida, where the better team didn't win that game. You know, is a team that deserved to win the game, but, you know, basically Virginia Tech is a team that is dangerous and is a good team, as they showed against Miami, actually. And they showed against Alabama when they gave them fits, and really it was three special teams plays that were the difference in that game. So, you know, it's a good team. Again, I think they're 12th in the F+. That's, you know, basically means that should that hold out, that Florida State will have about the same kind of challenge in the ACC championship game in terms of level of opponent, even though they've got three losses, that Bama would have in Missouri in terms of how well they've actually played adjusted for opponents. That said, I don't think that Virginia Tech will offer the kind of matchup problems for Florida State that you would expect or that I expect from Missouri towards Alabama. You know, you could argue that Virginia Tech has one of the three or four best defenses in the country. You know, they've got very, very good cornerbacks. They've got good defensive tackles. And my view has always been that if you have those two things, then you have what's necessary to have a very good defense. So at the end of the day, I think that's who Florida State needs to be gearing up for. That's where this Syracuse game winds up actually being a good practice for Florida State. I mean, obviously you don't want to take it as just a practice, but at the end of the day, that's what this is, you know, continuing to get better and playing a physical team that in many ways does a lot of what Virginia Tech does on both offense and defense. They just don't have the personnel on defense. When you take that, I think that this game will actually be good for Florida State's defense to have the chance to play against a team that's going to run a little bit more of what you would expect from Virginia Tech and what you might expect if you end up playing Bama. You know, these sorts of things. This is a good game for the defense to continue to adjust on that. All right, well, that's going to do it for our show. As always, on behalf of the rest of the Noel Digest staff, I'm Jason Staples. This has been the Unconquered Podcast. We look forward to talking to you again. I made this.